Hello, welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm your host, Andy Clef. Delighted to be joined today by Kim Davis, an Agile enthusiast, coach, consultant, and educator. Welcome.
Thank you, Andy. Thanks for having me.
Before we dive into today's oxymoronic topic of Agile in government, can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. New Jersey native. I have a background in software development. Got into Agile about a decade ago. I've been leading large and small transformations with our government partners. And my company, ASRC Federal, is an industry partner for a number of different agencies. So, you know, depending on everybody's use case, how mature they are, what constraints they have, we're faced with a number of different shaping opportunities, we like to call it, with our partners. So that's been a huge part of my focus for the last several years. I'm officially, my title is Senior Director of Software Applications and Analytics. We are across the U.S., even though I'm based in New Jersey. I also chair the Women in Agile Philadelphia group. I'm an active participant in Agile Philly.
Oh, great. Well, let's unpack that towards the end of the show. There's a lot of great stuff in there. Any secret superpowers that we're not going to find on your LinkedIn profile that we need to know about?
Yeah.
What do you got?
I'm an avid runner. Oh. I am a kickboxer. Mm-hmm. And I guess an amateur artist of sorts. I like to draw. And I've been told I'm pretty good. So I'll just go with that.
Are you finding solace in any of these three things in this current crazy time? We had a show a couple of weeks back about self-care. So I'm curious what people are doing.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, with getting up in the morning and getting kids out the door, going to work and coming home every day, working out is my outlet. And some days that would be a challenge. I get up every day and that's how I start my day. And when I don't, I don't feel as if I have the same level of energy that I would have on a particular day where I've done those activities first thing. So that is certainly something that I've increased, and it's become part of my daily routine. I do miss kickboxing. We can't do that right now. It's still closed due to COVID. Yeah. So I don't have the ability to roundhouse anything to cope, but at least I can get out and burn off some steam with a long distance run.
Oh my God. I can't imagine your retrospectives, right? Years back I did some Aikido and somebody brought in a full size dummy that was heavily weighted. That they had been using, and they brought it into the dojo because we were practicing with wooden weapons, the equivalent of a spear and a sword, and to make contact and to be able to follow through was a different way of practicing. So mm-hmm. when you do roundhouse kicks, are you making contact?
With a bag. Similar. They're not as heavy as, I know what you're talking about. They're almost weighted with sand and they're you would probably break your foot if you roundhoused one of those bags. So we have water-filled bags that are cushioned so that you don't break a limb or anything like that in action. But it's more like a cardio kickboxing, just, and I do that because for safety reasons.
you like your ankle and foot bones as they are.
Right, yeah. I'll just take it out on the bag, not an actual human being.
Awesome. All right. Segueing to today's topic, Agile in government. I hope to get educated in the next 45 minutes, because when I think of government work, I have a bias that you've got project managers, a PMO, it's full on Iron Triangle, budgets locked years in advance by funding, laws, regulations, you know, even when you get into the high tech industry, yes, we have something like the F-35 that's, you know, largely run on software, but how does it work? And am I totally mistaken? Or is there still a huge part of our government that runs in the 1970 to 1990 modality of development?
Honestly, there are still some agencies that struggle with that transition from how things were traditionally managed to the new way of being flexible with your contract structure. And again, it depends on the agency, where they are in their adoption. Because when you think, a lot of times they also think about Agile as, oh, it's software. So if I just tell them to go off and do this, they can just do it, right? And it's going to be awesome. But the reality is it's the business agility component. And so you have to consider that systems thinking aspect into how you reshape and retrain the mindset of that traditional thought process around program management to this new way of doing things. And we're starting to see a lot of that movement. And so some of them have gone as far as buying team capacity. So when you think about the Iron Triangle and how it's, you know, it shifts in the Agile mindset to having scope as the variable and cost and schedule as the fixed. So that shift and spin on the triangle has allowed us our partners, and combined with agents or industry partners like us, to think of contract vehicles like a firm fixed price or a firm fixed unit price and buying team capacity. So they'll go as far as saying, you know, we're expecting about a 9-person team, and based on their capacity, that's what we're going to pay for. And the schedule is this. And then once we go into something like program increment planning, if they're doing scaled Agile, you know, then we understand what scope can get done. So we're starting to see that, which is certainly a step in the right direction. I'll say, well, from like a compliance perspective, there are additional challenges into what we're faced with just from a programmatic perspective. When you think about like air gap systems and the complexities associated with a government value stream, like an operational value stream,
yeah,
that imposes a lot of logistics. And so my original work started in the DoD. So for example, you've got, you know, a user that's out in the field somewhere. Then you've got the government agency itself. Then you've got probably a prime that owns a piece of the program. And then some subs that own smaller pieces of that prime's work. And maybe you've got several people that own chunks of it. So just here's the user and here's a need to all of the steps it takes to get back to the user, just from the aspect of how it flows.
Yeah.
So, like, if the prime owns the systems requirements and the sub owns software development, you can't have that handoff just because it's different companies, right?
Yeah, it doesn't work.
So that systems thinking really applies there. And then like the DevOps cultural aspects is huge. Everybody's got to share responsibility for value delivery. And that's the bottom line. And until we get more and more acclimated with that, you still are faced with handoffs from government agency to vendor to vendor to vendor, then back to the user, right?
Yeah.
Or whatever physical equipment that's going to reside on.
I want to come back to the idea of buying capacity in that type of system, right? You say you're going to buy X people hours, but the efficiency of that system depends on so many factors. You know, when you've got primes and subs and subs and handoffs and delays, how can you have any idea of what you've actually purchased in that capacity bucket in terms of outcomes? Or is it right, just pure out points? We're buying 30 story points per week. I hope it's not like that.
No. Well, I'm not going to say no to everybody, but
because I've heard stories of, yeah, we have a contract. I don't think it was government. Yeah, we do 30 points a week. I'm like, interesting.
Right.
And so do you deliver? Always. And what do you do about defects? Oh, we point them too. I'm like, awesome. No wonder you're hitting 100% of your commitment.
Right.
So how does it work?
So one example, it has to go hand in hand with incremental planning. right? So if they were to, you know, look at the traditional mindset, I'm going to buy capacity for a year. It doesn't work like that, right? So they're doing it in chunks. And so if you look at a model where you've got program increments and it's 10 to 12 weeks, they're buying capacity for that 10 to 12 weeks on one example, right? I've seen other agencies go a little extreme on, they've talked about buying sprint capacity, but I think that has been overkill. But anyway, 10 to 12 weeks increment. And then once we get into the program increment planning, then we understand what the scope is for that increment, that 10 to 12 weeks. And at the plan, we've identified our objectives that we're going to measure value against at the end of that 10 to 12 weeks. So, and then through that, they've got their iterations planned into it. So they're using that cadence within, right, your 2-week cadence usually to yeah. inspect and see, are we on track for meeting our objectives or are we going to fall flat on our face, right? So that we're aligning this sprint of, or iteration objectives along the way. And at the end of that increment, we're saying, okay, based on the objectives that we established in the beginning of this program increment, we said we were going to do X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. They've all been given some type of value. So we look at them and measure, did we meet that value, that criteria? And they'll kind of assess that and give an actual value score. And it kind of creates this, well, you know, from each increment to each increment, this group, this capacity group that we bought has consistently achieved 80% of what they said they were going to do. Or 90% of what they said they were going to do. And so that's how it's really been measured in terms of, all right, we bought this and we don't know exactly what we want yet, but we're going to figure it out incrementally. And while we're working on one increment, we're also using all that detail that we figured out all the way along to inform what we expect to plan for the next increment.
Right.
So it's this cyclical thing, right? And if you, and sometimes we have task orders where you can buy capacity for this much, right? These 12 weeks, and then under the same task order, you can buy capacity for the next, right? And if you yeah. keep doing well, some of the task orders come with option years and you can extend it.
Nice. I'm curious, when you say we're measuring against value objectives, can you give some examples about what the customer, the end users value?
Yeah. So what they're looking at, you know, it varies.
Of course.
What we try to shape and influence, and this is a big deal too, is that it's not always about new capability. What everybody, you know, our users are the most important factor that goes into everything that we do. But we want to make sure that while we're giving them the needs that they require to meet some type of demand or use case, that we're also focusing on the flexibility, the extensibility of the systems that we're working on. So in terms of value, we're looking at making sure that we're starting with objectives that support new capability, that support technical agility, infrastructural needs, you know, architectural needs, maintenance. So it's important to understand what a balanced backlog looks like going into those increments. And while, you know, say an architectural enabler is put in as an objective for one program increment, obviously a user isn't going to get value out of that. But the business or the agency still is, because maybe it decoupled a monolithic application and now we can turn this one into a service, right? So they would put some type of ranking on that based on how it ranks with all of the objectives for that particular program increment.
Got it. So you're supporting both greenfield projects and brownfield projects, right?
Oh, yeah.
Legacy yeah. and brand new.
Yep.
How do you bid a brownfield? No, and who takes the risk?
Right.
and how do you decompose it into, in the next 12 weeks, it's just going to be figuring out how big of a mess this is, or if we can even unravel this thing and do and make it no longer monolithic. And,
yeah.
Who has the punch cards, by the way, right? I'm sure some of it can be good stories over a glass of wine. So, you know, is there a different approach to purchasing when you're doing greenfield versus brownfield is the short question.
Yeah, I believe that there is. I'll say a lot of what that we're involved with is more brownfield, but we're starting in more agencies that are a little bit more on the green side. And I'm not going to call them out specifically, but just to compare and contrast a green field. So how they bid new work, it's interesting. So your traditional bid process is the government releases an RFP, right? All the agencies compete. There's this long proposal process, and then there's a down select, and then there's an award, right? Now we're seeing more agility in the bidding process, which is interesting. We're seeing that some agencies, they want an orals component, which is a short, there's really no time to prepare. You get like 5 days to prepare, and it's more interview style. And this is just one particular agency, followed by a code challenge. So they want to see what you're actually doing and what type of CI/CD pipeline skills you have. What are you going to bring to the table? And then a pricing initiative. So they'll have like those three phases for one type of agency. Others have had a shortened proposal case studies to show specific past performance that relates to some unique use case that they have.
Yeah.
Followed by a very short tech volume, followed by orals. And then go a step further and have code challenges too. So we're starting to see more of that versus the traditional. And then how you handle the brownfield. Obviously, we own a lot of the legacy work that's been out there. And it's really about, for us, it's really about partnership. Everybody knows that, you know, if you've got a legacy application, it's got technical debt in it, right? It's got things that just need to evolve to support speed and to support flexibility and all the things that we need to drive the agile process, right? Again, it's more than just a process. And that's starting to catch on, which is a good thing. It's not just about, I know how to do Scrum, right?
No, it's so much more than that. It's nice to hear that the bidding process has adapted. A while ago, I did some public work and, you know, you pre-qualify bidders, they submit the RFP, and then you selected the lowest responsible bidder. And at the awards, the lowest responsible bidder, you know, I had an oh shit moment of like, what did I forget? Why am I so much lower than everybody else? And how am I going to fulfill this contract?
Right.
And so doing public works the old way was horrible. And so now that there's this process, which gives some more flexibility where it's not just lowest cost, right? It's technical competence, clarity, and prior history.
Yeah.
So that's a big shift in how the government buys stuff.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. And we're starting to see more and more of that catch on, but it takes time, right? I mean, especially if you're a large agency and you've got a lot of moving parts, you know, you can't just change it overnight. You've got to experiment with it and see what works. And even the agencies that have already established that type of process, it doesn't mean that the next time they put out a solicitation that it's going to be the same. They take in what they've learned from their bidding process and use that to reshape the next round of it. So it's very refreshing to see those changes at that level.
Oh, that's beautiful. Does what happens down in DC impact you day to day, quarter to quarter, administration to administration?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
How so?
So if there's something like sequestration, you know, in the past, we've had to furlough employees just because the funds aren't there right now, even though we know they'll come back. You know, some agencies have been impacted by COVID. And as a result, that's delayed our ability to bid on new work. So while we've had, you know, maybe projections for second and third quarters on win for 2020, those have all been delayed due to the impacts of COVID and how that's impacted the government. You know, things like that certainly impact us as our ability, you know, as a business. And then, of course, the from an Agile perspective, everything that is understood, and I understood with quotes, you know, at each agency level, impacts our ability to perform too. So for example, if we get, I caught one yesterday and it said, we want you to do Agile, all this stuff, iterations. And we heard about this acronym called INVEST.
Can you help us do deep investing with Agile, with the Agile?
Called the Agile Manifesto, right? But wait, we want you to do phases. So the first phase is requirements, the second phase software, and the third phase is test. I was like, well, wait, so they want waterfall. So that, you know, if we're going after that work, we have to be compliant. To be compliant, we have to respond to how they ask us to respond, right? And then assuming we win, then we have to then work to shift that mindset. You've got to start off that way because that's what you said you were going to do in your proposal, right? But then you have to find ways to find shaping opportunities to change it to what they really want. And in some cases too, you have to be careful. You don't want your government partners to think that this thing we thought was Agile that is really waterfall, this Agile thing doesn't work, right? Because it's not Agile.
Right.
It's a bad rap. And in some cases, we've seen some really higher up government officials say, you know, put out declarations that, oh, we're not going to do this framework. I've observed it somewhere and it's awful. And then that has a ripple effect on us too, because we can't say in certain agencies that have that opinion, oh, that we're scaled Agile experts, because that's
taboo.
Said something not good about it, right? So, you know, we have to be cognizant of what the general government culture feels and what each agency feels. And, you know, but all along, our goal is to partner, and we understand that, we empathize with that. Our partnership is about that mindset shift and shaping it in a way that they can see the value in it. So, long answer to that, but...
No, but it's packed with really great things, and I love the word shaping as opposed to transformation, which is just as abused as Agile. Right. And nobody knows what the heck it means, and partnership. But man, talk about mindset and cultural shaping when you go into any government, particularly federal, that has a history, I'm sure, of hierarchy, command and control. There's rules, there's contracts, and you're trying to cross gaps that could be a leap or require a huge bridge. Mm-hmm. What are some examples or some ways that you're approaching that? Because as you said, you have to be responsive, but on the other hand, you still have to deliver. And if you're being brought in to do something that's empirical, but they're making you do a defined process, mini waterfalls, you know it's not going to work, but you're in this tug of war of like, yeah, I can't do that, but I can't do this. So what's your partnership shaping approach to changing mindsets, changing cultures?
Yeah.
Without giving away too many trade secrets.
Yeah. This is another thing that varies from group to group. One thing that has always resonated well is just how do you create a visual around reality and then slowly start to create those small wins. So the visual around reality, one example I have that always comes to my mind, and it's simple. I'm working with one agency that had 42 different configurations all being developed in parallel, right? So a very large, complex legacy organization. This was going back a couple of years at least, and they were practicing components of scaled Agile, not really fully embraced at that point. They were really still unsure of which direction they wanted to go in, but they knew that that level of coordination and dependency mapping was really critical. But anyway, so we would go off and do what at the time was called release planning. It's now PI planning. They would, you know, we'd come out with these plans for all these 42 different configurations that were mapped out against 20 different release trains. And as soon as the plans were approved and, you know, there was arguing about priorities and, you know, it was always the loudest person in the room gets all the work, right? Or who's got the most money. And we fixed that too, but I'll get to that in a second. It was just pandemonium because they would say, all right, plans are approved, go off and start, right? So what happens when you start everything? You end up with a massive bottleneck, right? And then your release burn down charts look like a giant plateau. So they're like, this doesn't work. This agile thing, we're not getting it right. So I'm like, well, here's a visual. Here's reality, right? The reality is that even though we prioritize things, that food fight doesn't mean anything. A program manager that's incentivized by waterfall-y types of things, he's still laying around in contracts, is still going to tell his team to go off and do something regardless of which priority that program or configuration was given, right?
Yep.
So what we had to do was really take all everything and put it all together and just show, look, this is what work looks like. And it goes flat and then it drops at the very end. So the whole concept, I'm like, is anybody doing sprint demos? And they'd be like, no.
We set them up, but we canceled them.
We talk about them, but we don't have anything to demo, right? Aha. Okay. So what we had to do was implement like a program portfolio Kanban board with explicit entrance and exit criteria from column to column, work in process limits. We use weighted shortest job first for prioritization. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line was we had to get that leadership team to collaborate on who was actually going to start their work following the rules of what a weighted shortest job type of prioritization model provides, right? So a total leadership shift. But then once they started to see the change, they got it, right? So it was about presenting a visual and that here's a small victory. In other agencies, like value stream mapping has gone over extremely well to show, you know, the lag and the ripple effect. If, you know, the upfront stuff isn't right, how that even has on going through the whole steps, all the steps. And then we use a lot of maturity models too.
Nice. And that got rid of your problem of decibel prioritization.
Yes. Yeah.
She who screams loudest. Before we wrap up, historically, there's a few poster children for, you know, organizational transformation in the government. There was, you know, the original healthcare.gov, which was the way not to do it. And I guess 18F came in and sort of saved the day, and they continue on in government services. Who else is getting it right in this world in terms of government and agile? Mm. Oh, you're not allowed to say, are you? You're, NDA, secrecy, top secret clearance. Are there people out there that are adopting and inspecting and adapting and making progress?
Absolutely. There absolutely are. And I don't want to call out anybody specifically, but the best scenarios where we see the biggest change is, I'll go back to that concept of DevOps culture. And that's just so applicable to so many different ways that you think about working together. And so when you have that and it's fully embraced, coupled with the lean agile leadership mindset, you get that, it's supported, right? You're leading by example. You're getting out there as a leader and you're talking to people about what they're experiencing, and you're getting out to the users and you're incorporating their voice through the entire value stream, right? through your whole pipeline, software development pipeline. And then like the systems thinking aspect too, it goes a long way. So, you know, you're only as fast as your weakest cog in the whole system.
Right.
And then, so when you start talking to them about that and them being just the community of people that are involved, I think it turns on a couple of light bulbs and they start thinking about, well, a system, right? So we really do have to work together. If you think about an engine and a gear is off, the whole thing is going to be off, right? So yeah. It certainly has a ripple effect. And the agencies and the groups that have started to really think that way have had the best success moving forward with whatever type of implementation that they are using or that they're embracing. And even within certain agencies, because they've got multiple contracts, mm-hmm. they're not like, oh, well, I only do Scrum. Right? No, that doesn't work that way, right? they're thinking like, oh, okay, well, it makes sense to support Scaled Agile here because it is a huge program. Or over here, it's kind of small, so we're going to support them in doing Kanban or whatever, right? So the mindset shift and the less like you shall do is becoming more of a, hey, what do we think as a community? And that's a great thing. That goes a long way.
It goes a long way in any digital transformation, whether it's government, private, nonprofit sector. And yeah. I think you've said it, we've seen it, all our listeners see it. The team only got so far before it hits some system constraint or organizational constraint, which is often, you know, a leadership layer that needs to unlock the capabilities rather than the old school of controlling it.
Right. Yeah.
Well, thank you for opening up my mind to what's going on and the possibilities. Before we close out, I want to give you an opportunity to share some shout outs, upcoming events, and the best ways for our listeners to get a hold of you, Kim Davis.
Sure. Thank you.
Tell us more about the groups you support that we mentioned at the beginning of the show.
Yeah. So Women in Agile is a nonprofit organization. It's worldwide and it's community-based, which is a passion of mine. I wanted to start something in my local area. I'm a New Jersey resident. I live in the southern part. So Philadelphia is my closest city. So we kicked off this group last fall. We had a number of sessions. We had three until COVID hit. And then, so we're looking at the virtual ways of promoting things. So one of the things that we're going to be kicking off soon is just a way to network virtually. I think, especially during these times, people look for that connection. So, and this is something I'm doing at my company as well for a women's impact network that we have internally. But anyway, it's just a small groups of people based on whoever who signed up. Each group has a facilitator, they get together and they just network and it helps them kind of, who else is in this Agile Philly group, Women in Agile Philly group, get to know each other on a personal level. It's different when you're going to events, right? Because you're kind of engaged on the topics and the speakers and whatever else is going on. But that community aspect is also really important. And it's also a big part of Women in Agile's charter as well. And then I've been a speaker at Agile Philly. Don't know what we're doing this year with COVID.
Nobody does.
I enjoy supporting that group and I'm a part of other, you know, conferences and that sort of thing. I enjoy speaking and just sharing experiences with others when I have the opportunity to do so. I am on LinkedIn. I know there's a lot of Kim Davises out there, so you can find me at Kimberly Davis, somewhat of a discriminator. And I have some Slack channels too, but I think LinkedIn is probably the best way to reach me via the internet.
Via the internet. We'll include links in the show notes to both the Women in Agile at large, the Philly group, and then Kimberly Davis's LinkedIn.
Yeah. Oh, and for Women in Agile Philly, we also have a meetup site. You can go there and join our group. We have a LinkedIn page as well. Our meetup site is how we organize events, and LinkedIn is how we work on communicating and that community aspect too. So if you're interested, check out those two groups as well.
Great. Thanks again, Kim Davis. And to you, our listening audience, if you enjoyed this show and you made it this far, give us a rating, a review, or leave some comments in your podcast app of choice. It helps others find us. And if this is your first time tuning in and you've made it this far as well, subscribe, hit the next one. If you'd like to join our discussion and share your stories about other oxymorons like agile and government, and what you've got in your gin and tonic to bring out the aromics. This is where post-production comes in. But I think I'll just leave that in. You know, what are you putting in your gin and tonic to bring out the flavor? Join us on our Discord server. There's lots of ongoing conversations. You'll find a link at agileuprising.com. And really, if you're feeling generous and you'd like to help us cover our hosting and production costs, see the show notes for how you can become a patron. For just pennies a day, or if you pony up $5 a month, we'll send you a surprise envelope filled with all kinds of good swag that you can brag about with your partners and kids, and they'll be like, what is that thing you got in the mail? Until next time, this is the Agile Uprising Podcast, signing out.
Thank you.